talks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Good morning. This is Talking Animals, the special equine edition. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is Ellie Phipps Price, the writer-producer of American Mustang, a film that, blending elements of documentary and narrative feature, deals with the ongoing roundup of wild horses by the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM. These captured Mustangs are often left indefinitely in holding facilities or, worse, sent off to slaughter. Narrated by Daryl Hannah, American Mustang is slated to be shown in Tampa one night only, August 25th at the AMC West Shore 14 at the West Shore Plaza in Tampa. We'll find out more about American Mustang and that screening when we speak with Ellie Phipps Price in a few moments here on Talking Animal. Later in the show is the prize for Name That Animal Tune. We'll be offering a Talking Animals t-shirt, of course. Just a very few left before we totally run out. None in medium, by the way, but we have some in all other sizes. Also, as part of today's show, which we're making all equestrian-oriented, the interview with Ellie Phipps Price, the animal comedy piece, the animal songs, including the one for Name That Animal Tune, will all be horse-related. And so, partly with that in mind, I want to talk for a moment about a horse that passed away a few days ago. First, the situation involves a juxtaposition I hope not to duplicate any time soon. Friday evening, I was over here for the Oddball Comedy Festival. It was a fun night featuring some of today's best comedians, made more fun by hanging with the fabulous Flea. We had adventures, misadventures, and lots of big laughs. The next morning, the mood changed considerably. As I was driving back to my side of the state, my wife called me very upset, saying she didn't have many details, but had been told that Nairobi, the retired dressage champion, belonged to the folks next door and had become the companion at our house of Sir Jurley, the horse we'd adopted, had severely re-injured his leg and was going to have to be put down. They were waiting for the veterinarian to arrive to euthanize Nairobi. I drove like a bat out of hell, and when I got to our house, I ran out to where Jules, the daughter of the mother-daughter team who run the horse operation next door and who'd ridden Nairobi to all those championships. You can actually see them in action on YouTube, by the way. Was sitting crying while comforting Nairobi, who was on the ground. They were still awaiting the vet, and Sir Jurley was lurking nearby, clearly aware something bad was happening to his friend. I stayed with Jules and Nairobi trying to comfort the horse. Well, trying to comfort them both, really. Which got really hairy when he stood up. The poor guy, his bum leg could no longer support him, but his fierce spirit was driving him to keep going. Finally got him to lay back down, where he stayed while there was more soft words and comforting and tears until the vet arrived. It was a very sad farewell, including Sir Jurley lying down near his dying friend, but I grew more insights from this about living with and loving animals, and whether it's a small, wiry house cat or a big, strapping horse, saying goodbye is really tough and very, very sad. Rest in peace, Nairobi. We're going to kick things off with an animal song, a horse song masking a more existential rumination, which also seems appropriate this morning. It's John Doe.
There's a black horse in a photograph. His mane blows in your face. There's a black horse in a photograph. His mane blows in your face. Your eyes are hidden. Will you be taken? Feathers shadow of blackbirds, as many as in a pie. The shadow of blackbirds, as many as baked in a pie. Pass over your burnt head, you prepare to die.
That was There's a Black Horse from John Doe. Currently kicking up much more of a racket as he and the rest of X barnstorm across the country on a new tour that people everywhere are raving about. Of course, it's X playing some albums in their entirety. Let's move now into our chat with Ellie Phipps Price about the film she co-wrote, American Mustang, with the reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing us at dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Ellie Phipps Price, the Talking Animals. Good morning, Ellie.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
Terrific to be able to talk about it.
Yeah, and of course, we will be talking about American Mustang, obviously, but since the film reflects an important interest of yours, some really important issues that are, of course, contained in the film, but obviously, you're a horse person from way back, I'm guessing. Where did you grow up, and when did horses first enter your world, or you enter theirs?
Well, I guess from the beginning would be in Southern California, and I, you know, grew up horse crazy girl, and you know, rented horses, leased horses, rode a little bit the hunter jumpers in Southern California, and then I lived in Colorado, where I actually fox hunted for years also, and lived on a ranch, on a cattle ranch. So I was kind of surrounded by horses then, and then I took a break and you know, went to school and all that, and then all of a sudden they came back, I guess. And I came back to horses, to riding, and eventually discovered wild horses.
And so what sort of precipitated the break, and I guess more to the point, what then sort of prompted the return to horses?
So I think, like, and this was really a challenge for us with the movie, was to try to show how wild horses are different than domestic horses, although there is obviously a lot of crossover that you can... You can take a wild horse and domesticate it or gentle it, and they can become great riding horses. And the Bureau of Land Management has a wonderful program to help people adopt Mustangs that they remove from the range. But for me, before I knew anything about all that, I was just someone, I saw horses as, you know, a companion, and I appreciated their, you know, capacity to connect with people and you know, show up for you to, you know, jump a fence or just things like that to compete. It wasn't really until I learned about, you know, wild horses as wild animals and how they lived on the range. And I guess the thing that brought that to my attention was a book called Mustang, which was by Deanne Stillman. And it's an amazing history of the wild horse in America and the evolution of the horse on the North American continent, but it's also really our history. You know, it's the history of the American people, and it's literally, you know, Deanne in her book says this is, you know, the horse we rode in on. And I love that idea, and I loved looking at how this animal has partnered with us historically. You know, cowboys and Indians and all that aside, as cavalry mounts and pulling carts and making farming possible. You just, you know, this is how our country was built.
Yeah, and the film really does deal with that, sort of laying the groundwork for the sort of core themes of the film. But you really do see sort of the history of the horse coming to the United States, and sort of a summary of how that worked. So in Deanne's book or otherwise, how far back does the history of the wild horses being rounded up extend?
Well, as far as them being rounded up, I mean, at one point they estimated that there were possibly 2 million wild horses roaming the western range of the North American continent. And they were basically just, you know, ranchers would mix their stock with wild horses sometimes. They would use, you know, go out and catch a few horses and bring them onto their ranch and use them. As I said, you know, they were used for cavalry mounts. But then basically as ranching developed in the 30s and 40s, and there was competition for grazing, there was also this idea that they could just harvest these horses as a commodity and make them into dog food. And they were rounded up and, I mean, brutally removed from the range, and a population of 2 million was reduced to, they think, maybe 17 or 20,000 by the late 60s.
Wow.
And so with that, all of a sudden, with a woman named Wild Horse Annie, who was in Nevada, and an amazing character who we cover her story a little bit in our movie. We just touch upon it. But she's just somebody who saw what was happening just by chance. She saw some horses being very badly treated, and she did an exploration of what was going on, and she did rallied the children of the United States to write a letter-writing campaign. And these letters were delivered to the floor of Congress, and, you know, our elected representatives took notice of Wild Horse Annie and her mission and decided to create, to protect wild horses in the wild on the range. So that was 1971, and that's why we still have them, is because these protections were created to keep them from all being just, you know, sold down the road to slaughter.
Yeah, well, certainly Wild Horse Annie is a pivotal part of the film from sort of a few angles, both just the in the sort of documentary side, but then, as we'll get into maybe in a moment or two, there's sort of this feature narrative element to the movie as well. And so there's this young girl, I should say, I guess, who has her eye on a Mustang that's been rounded up, and she's one of the sort of storylines of the film, is she's very enamored of the horse and hopes to obviously adopt the horse or get involved with the horse, but she's also doing a report on various things, and so Wild Horse Annie is sort of crucial to her as well.
Yeah, we you know, children sometimes see things that's harder for the rest of us to see, and we really wanted to make a film that was family friendly, appeal to everyone, that could tell the history and the story of the horse. But having this this device of a narrative built into a documentary allowed us to get out, you know, on the range in, you know, 8 different states and find wild horses and film them and build, you know, the story of what real wild horses are, and layer that with the story of this girl, this 14-year-old girl, who sees, you know, what it is to take a horse from the wild and make it, you know, somebody's horse.
We're sort of jumping ahead to something, this part that I wanted to explore, but we may as well get into it now since we're here. So we'll come back to sort of how the film actually got going and what the rationale behind it was. But once there was clearly a film, what more specifically, what was sort of the creative or writing process behind not just having it be a documentary, but having the storyline that you say kind of layering over that?
Well, the writing process, we started with this idea that we wanted to have a 3D film, that we wanted to really bring people in close and connect them emotionally to the horses in the wild. And so we decided to take the leap and shoot this film in 3D, which was challenging with wild horses because those are really big cameras and the setup is difficult and stuff like that. But we got that footage, and then to do this narrative story, it was actually, we didn't want to do a typical documentary with talking heads, which I love those kinds of movies, and I've grown up on them. But we really wanted to stay away from that and just weave our documentary with kind of an unfolding narrative. And so we wrote a character of a cowboy. We interviewed ranchers, we interviewed wildlife biologists and scientists, we interviewed BLM employees, people who manage wild horses on the range, who study them, who work with them, and advocates and wild horse advocates, the people that are taking a stand for them to try to protect them in the wild. And we compiled all of these interviews, and we have footage of all those interviews too, so that, I guess, could be a whole other movie. And we wrote, my co-producer Henry Ansbacher, who has a social justice production company out of Denver called Just Media, and Henry and I wrote the movie. We wrote it based on these interviews, and, you know, he's a father and has young children, My children are a little older, but I'm definitely, you know, I'm a horse person. And so we put together our experience and what we learned, and we wrote the story into the documentary.
It's really, it's an unusual hybrid for sure. And so I gather from what you've already sort of touched on that the idea was that A, you did not want to do a conventional documentary, but B, going this way was the idea that this would make the film more gripping, more persuasive, and therefore maybe more effective?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's an interesting process because, you know, when some people have watched the movie, at first they're a little like, what is this? Is this a feature? Is this a story? Is it real? Is the cowboy real? Is that a real wild horse? Is that a real Mustang? And everything in the movie is real. You know, we went to the to a BLM holding facility and adopted two Mustangs, one of them to be our primary character and the second one to be basically the backup horse or the double. And so we cut back and forth between those two horses to show one horse being gentled by a cowboy, and we use, you know, real cowboys. They're real horsemen. They start 200 colts a year, each of them, across, all around the world, from Australia to Hawaii to, you know, Texas. And these two guys are tops in their business. And then we cast an actress to play the girl. And we dropped her into the story, and we follow her following the horse and the cowboys. It's definitely an interesting, you know, we've been invited to screen for the Directors Guild in Los Angeles, I think next week. And, you know, people that they're interested in, you know, innovative filmmaking have noticed our film.
No, absolutely.
You guys did something very different.
Right. So. Well, there's not only sort of the basic documentary meets narrative feature thing that we've discussed, but there's a lot of other elements sort of incorporated in. I mean, I think I mentioned in the introduction before even bringing you on the air, Ellie, that the a large part of the film, at least, is narrated by Daryl Hannah, and there's just there's visual graphics, there's footage of old films, there's a lot going on, and yet it all seems like a cohesive piece, but again, an unusual film in this regard as well.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it is different, and it's only 70 minutes, and which means it's very easy to just kind of sit down, drop in, and let it unfold, and, you know, we're excited to be screening in Tampa. We have that screening coming up, I think, August 25th.
We'll come back to that a few times, but let's, while we're on that, screening is slated for Monday, August 25th at the AMC West Shore 14, which is West Shore Plaza in Tampa, and it's a so-called tug screening, which I don't know if you want to explain that, Ellie, or I will, but it's an interesting idea, and a lot of these kinds of films are more and more screened this way, but do you want to explain kind of basic conceit is?
To make it simple and make sense to people is, you know, since we're not a big studio picture and don't have that kind of distribution, we really, as a 3D film, we really wanted to be seen in theaters before, you know, we eventually get to other, you know, ways that people can see the movie. We wanted to be seen in theaters on the big screen, and so there is a program, it's crowdsourced distribution, which basically, there's a company called TUG, T-U-G-G, and people can go to the TUG.com website, and they can see the movies that they have. An American Mustang is there, and you can sponsor the film. You basically say, I will bring American Mustang to my town, and here's a theater that's my local theater that I like, and would you bring American Mustang to my theater? And then TUG contacts the theater and sets up the screening. And the difference is you have a special screening set up, but what happens is you have to sell the tickets in advance. That's the challenge, is you have to get the word out about the movie, sell the tickets in advance, and then once you reach that threshold of minimum number of tickets sold, then the screening gets greenlit, and it happens. And we're doing it, I think, across the country from Alaska to Florida, and we have over 30 screenings pending. I think we have five tomorrow, five different states.
One of the things what I sort of liken tug screenings too, in a way, it's just at least in a, just a rough comparison, is that it's sort of like a Groupon purchase, that a certain number of people do have to commit to the purchase, or in this case, the screening, or it doesn't move forward. So, so it's really critical if for people who are interested in seeing American Mustang in Tampa, that that you get your tickets, reserve your tickets, and do so now. And in fact, you can do that by one simple way to get there, by going to floridavoicesforanimals.org, since Florida Voices for Animals is actually presenting the screening. But while we're on that, let me let folks know this is Talking Animals. My guest is Ellie Phipps Price, co-writer of American Mustang, a film exploring the roundup of wild horses by the Bureau of Land Management, BLM. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So speaking of that, among the emails that have come in, Ellie, let's see if you'd like to respond to this. So this subject line says question, and then in quotes at the top, it says, a Mustang is a free-roaming horse in boldface of the North American boldface West that first descended from horses brought boldface to the Americas by the Spanish. Then down below it, it says the term quote-unquote American Mustang was coined to distract from the fact that they're just another native species, which I assume they mean species. They have had many negative impacts on the native species that compete with them for limited food in the West. Why should they be treated differently than anacondas or other non-native species which threaten native endangered species? They're a problem when looked at. This is a bit of rough writing here, but anyway, there's something like they're a problem when looked at with logic and reason instead of emotion.
Right. Well, you know, I think the whole native, not native argument is kind of like chasing squirrels around the trees. The whole idea of are they native? Yes, they were. The horse itself, Equus caballus, evolved on the North American continent before any of us and before many other species that we know about. And then it was thought that, and this was millions of years ago, and then it was thought that they disappeared from the North American continent and traveled over the Bering Land Bridge into Europe and Asia. And then established over there, they were reintroduced by Cortez and the Spanish explorers in the 1500s. And so that's where this idea of them being non-native, or more accurately, native reintroduced would be, you know, a native reintroduced species would be more accurate. Interestingly, in the last, 5 years, they've found several different archaeological sites where they are finding these bones of horses that were here during that time when they thought they had disappeared. And so now this whole are they native conversation is a little bit on its head of, is this really, you know, what we want to base our conversation on? And to me, I think the point is, and I admit it's a romantic idea, is that they were here before us. They've been living here and serving us and been our partner. These horses that evolved here also have mixed with horses that, you know, served us in wars and carried us into battle and did everything else. And yes, that's a romantic idea, but it's also true. And I think to just throw them under the bus and say they're not native and they're competing with our privately owned livestock, you know, on public lands for grazing, which is, you know, the primary argument here, is from ranchers who have privately owned livestock and they're grazing on public land.
That kind of swings us back into a couple of things. One, back to the explanation that you already offered about Wild Horse Annie and what happened in 1971. One question sort of related to that may or may not constitute the $64,000 question is that with that legislation in place since 71, why do the BLM roundups happen? And what is it that the BLM seeks to accomplish with these roundups?
Well, in the big picture, and I know to not just go on and make it too complicated. In the big picture, the BLM is managing about 245 million acres of land. And on that land, there's privately owned livestock grazing on the majority of it in the North America, if you don't count Alaska. And wild horses are on a small percentage of that. They're on, I think, 11% of that. And on that 11%, they're sharing, you know, the lion's share of the forage is still going to livestock. Like 87% of the forage is still going to livestock. And what's happening is wild horses are very good at reproducing. And that's the problem. They are good at reproducing. They are they're great at surviving in tough circumstances, and they find a way, and they find a way to stay out there. And they are competing for grazing, and the BLM is managing them by rounding them up with helicopters and removing them from the range and putting them into holding. The travesty right now is we have 50,000 formerly wild horses that are just standing around in government holding at taxpayer expense, and they've lost everything. They've lost their freedom, their families, their whole kind of sense of being, you know, what makes them, you know, what they are. And they just don't have a good program in place. The BLM is not using birth control. They talk about it, but less than 1% of their budget goes towards using birth control. And, you know, I think they've failed. The management program has failed, and there needs to be reform.
Well, a couple things there. One is at one point in the film, there's this very stentorian voice who's obviously a cattle rancher saying raising cattle essentially is the best use of this land, and going on to say Mustangs are basically trespassing. So that's certainly one view. But I assume in some ways that kind of encapsulates part of the core conflict here.
Yeah, I think it does. And you know, having lived on a ranch and having families that are in the business and knowing, having friends who are ranchers, and most ranchers don't want to see every wild horse removed, but they would like to see the populations controlled with birth control or whatever's the most humane and method that would work. I think, you know, we didn't want to demonize ranchers in the movie, but there is a dynamic set up. If there isn't a good management in place, it just leaves the horses in the crossfire. And basically, that's where the rub is. That's where, you know, ranchers have their interests and want to protect their business. And, you know, the wild horses don't have a voice except for, you know, advocates and people who, like me, who are standing up and saying, you know, we can't just throw them under the bus.
So this brings me to this. So as you've just explained, the BLM is overseeing 245 million acres of land. Help me get a better understanding of the BLM. Is it an agency that, just given that number of acres, for example, is just overwhelmed by the task at hand? Or is it worse than that? Because it's hard at times watching the film to determine if they're something more nefarious at work, or are they just so overwhelmed by the sheer numbers of everything, the number of acres, the number of horses, everything.
I think, you know, I'm not an expert on, you know, this government agency and all their responsibilities, but I think it's almost the opposite of that, they've kind of thought this wasn't an important thing. It's not a big part of their budget. You know, the BLM is huge. They're dealing with mining, and they're dealing with so many land issues that are so important. The wild horses have kind of been this nuisance issue for them, and what they tried to do was just kind of push it under the rug, get rid of it. You know, like, treat them like livestock. Round them up, put them in pens, and then we'll deal with it later. And, you know, when it wasn't working and they were stockpiling, you know, more and more horses, and the horse market is fallen apart since 2008 and the economy crashing and all that, they basically have, you know, just kind of held their hands up in the air and said, oops, now we rounded up 50,000 horses and we don't know what to do with them, and holding is full, so we just don't know what to do. And, you know, they did commission a study with the National Academy of Sciences, and that study, which cost a few million dollars and took a couple of years, said they need to use the tools that they have to manage these horses. And that's birth control. Mm-hmm. They have it. They need to use it.
And why is that so difficult? Because, sort of skipping around, but in a way, hopefully fleshing out the picture here, one thing that is clear is that there's a sanctuary that I think is your sanctuary, but at any rate, where clearly there is a way to, even with a large number of horses, to administer a form of birth control.
Yeah, I mean, there is a way to do it, and it would mean changing their management practice. You know, it would mean, instead of doing these, you know, rounding up horses and, you know, removing them, you'd round them up or gather them with bait trapping, and then you would dart the mares with PZP, which is the vaccine, and you would start to control the populations. Right now, they've destabilized the horses in the wild so much that they're actually reproducing more rapidly, which is something that they point out in the NAS report. And, you know, it's just their whole management method needs to be reviewed.
Well, I guess that's what I was alluding to earlier. It just seems like they're just, as you've noted, they have a lot of other things that they're responsible for and trying to manage. But when it comes to this, it just seems like they're kind of finger in the dike sort of management style. And
yeah.
So,
and the closer you get to it, the more it's such a tragedy. Now, attending a roundup is absolutely the most ridiculous, tragic, sad thing I can do. You know, you go there and you see out on this land, you see these beautiful horses, and compared to how much sheep and cows are out there, there's not very many. And then they go in with the helicopters, which is very expensive, and they push these horses 5, 10, 20 miles. You know, you have babies trying to keep up with their moms. You have older horses that can't keep up. It takes days. They finally gather, you know, round them all up, gather them all together, and sort them out, and separate the males and the females, and take the stallions in one direction and the mares and babies in another. And they make a lot of noise about these horses are going up for adoption. Well, I mean, horses are languishing and holding for, you know, 5 or 7 years and then moving to other holding. They're not getting adopted. Last year, 2,000 horses were adopted, something like that.
Yeah, a drop in the proverbial bucket, it sounds like, really.
Yeah. So you look at this and you just think, wait a minute, if you have too many horses out here, all you need to do is start bringing them in, treating them with birth control, and maintain your population on the range. I mean, they have herd management areas. They're supposed to be protected there. And this isn't protecting them. This isn't managing them. This is throwing them under the bus.
And the other thing, too, that I think it's important for us to at least touch on is that not only are they held for many years in those pens, but darker things can happen and do happen as well. For instance, let's address Tom Davis. Maybe you could talk about who he is and how he figures into American Mustang, if not sort of the larger wild horse BLM story.
Well, Tom Davis is somebody who, I think mostly in 2009, and it was discovered, and basically I don't think he was ever served any time for this one or got in that much trouble, but this is a livestock dealer who happened to be from the same hometown as our Secretary of the Interior, Salazar, which was an interesting connection, but he wasn't somebody who worked for Salazar or had any real connection to him that way, but it was during Salazar's tenure as Secretary of the Interior, which oversees the BLM, and Tom Davis was able to buy horses at $10 a piece by the truckload, and over time he bought, I think, 1,700 horses, and some of those horses, probably most of those horses, went to slaughter. He wasn't able to prove where they went or show where they went. He openly said, you know, things like, well, what would be wrong with sending those horses to slaughter? They're all fat and shiny and, you know, what else are you going to do with them kind of thing. And, you know, so this guy's a proponent of slaughter and was just blatantly buying horses directly from BLM and putting them on trucks and sending them to Mexico. Horses, some of the horses in our movie are from the White Mountain herd management area, which is where many of Tom Davis's horses were from. That was the connection that we were able to show, you know, what happens to the horses that slip through the cracks. And, you know, right now they have truckloads of horses that have just disappeared off of a holding facility. And there's an alert out, and they're looking for, I think, 30 horses, you know, that have left a holding facility on a truck, and they think they're going to slaughter.
Yeah, well, that's why I want to be sure, even though it's unpleasant, to touch on this in our conversation, because people listening who might not be all that familiar with the whole BLM roundup of wild horses think, okay, well, that doesn't sound great, but they're sitting in a pen. What's so bad about that? But I mean, that is bad because of what happens and just to those horses and sort of their whole family dynamics and all kinds of other things. But yeah, it's way worse with the Tom Davises of the world out there as well.
Yeah, and I think the whole idea of, you know, the BLM saying, well, we're protecting these horses, we're managing them the best we can. We haven't been able to use birth control yet, but we're going to. That's kind of their line right now. The reality is what happens is a lot of horses get adopted and it doesn't work out. And then those horses get sold and end up in the pens, you know, being bought by kill buyers. And I rescue those horses. You know, I know a lot of people that do. But we can't rescue them all. We can't rescue our way out of this situation, and we can't adopt our way out of this situation. We need to, you know, probably it's going to take legislation, and it's going to take people getting organized, getting together, and saying there's a better way to do this.
Well, we're just sort of nearing the end of our time, but again, my guest is Ellie Phipps Price, co-writer of American Mustang, film exploring the topic of course, we're discussing at the moment, the Roundup of Wild Horses by the Bureau of Land Management. American Mustang will be shown August 25th in Tampa. Tickets and information about that screening can be found at floridavoicesforanimals.org. Meanwhile, I have just a minute or two, maybe more, but and we have some emails here, so let me get to those. But let me first, before we get into one or two of those emails, Ellie, let me say with the importance of legislation and to really affect any sort of important change, what do you and the American Mustang team hope to achieve with the film in terms of affecting change? Is it raising kind of the awareness, and then hopefully there'll be a greater sense of outrage that will move towards that kind of legislative change?
Yeah, well, what we really wanted to do was raise awareness, you know, that they're out there and what they are, and, you know, what they are in the wild and what's lost when we take them off the range and throw them into holding and, you know, do what they're doing to them right now. We wanted to basically introduce people to the history, introduce people to what's going on with current management, and offer up that we think there's a better way. We feel like we are part of a grassroots campaign. We're very closely affiliated with the American Wild Horse Preservation Campaign, which people can find by going to stoptheroundups.com, which is easy to remember. Stoptheroundups.com takes you to the campaign. We also have a Facebook and website and a letter-writing campaign, postcard campaign to Secretary Sally Jewell, our current Secretary of the Interior, who has not addressed this issue at all. And we try to, you know, organize and mobilize people to take a stand for the horses. You know, there's proposing roundups going on right now, which would basically, you know, wipe out Wyoming's wild horses. And, you know, there's, you know, a temporary hold on that roundup, but they're still trying to make that go forward in September. And that would take over 800 horses off the range in Wyoming, which would effectively wipe out wild horses in Wyoming. I mean, there's places right now where people can go to get more information and hopefully connect to the issue and be part of finding a better way.
Well, what you said about the Secretary of Interior, Sally Jewell, hooks in one part, at least one of the emails that has come in. It says, "Hi, could you please tell me if things are getting any better for the wild horses? Are there any wild horse advocates within the state and federal governments?" And sort of almost as an aside, it says the BLM sounds like such a mess. But but are there, I guess, you know, maybe the salient question in that email is, are there wild horse advocates within the state and federal governments that will help collectively, at least, with the legislative shift that you guys are seeking?
Yeah, I mean, you know what I think there are there. There's been some real champions of, you know, they tend to be the same people who take a stand on animal welfare issues. Their problem is finding Western senators who will take a stand when ranching is such a powerful interest in the West. But I do think there are great people out there. There's a lot of people, they've done signed letters, for, you know, sign-on letters and petitions, and they're part of the conversation, and you know, we meet with them regularly. But right now, I think there's a little bit of a feeling, which everybody knows about, of this is a very difficult time to get anything done in Washington. And, you know, if legislation is the answer here, and we can't, you know, get any legislation passed with this Congress, and very little is going down, you know, this is going to be a really tough one to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, the timing on this may be maybe next year. It's not going to be this year.
Well, Ellie, thank you so much for your time. We have reached the end of our time, a little beyond, but I just felt this was so important. So let me run down some key websites. So first of all, just again, a reminder that the American Mustang is slated to screen in Tampa August 25th at the AMC West Shore 14 at the West Shore Plaza in Tampa. Folks can get tickets or just more information about that screening via floridavoicesforanimals.org. The film website is American Mustang The Movie. .com, and we also want to send folks to stoptheroundups.com. Ellie, thank you so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals, and the film that you made that I hope really does shift things around, even if we have to be a little more patient than we'd like.
Yeah, Duncan, thank you so much. It's really been nice to talk to you, and thanks for helping us get the word out, and hope everyone will get their tickets to the Tampa screening.
Absolutely. Thanks again, Ellie.
All right, thank you so much. Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye. Let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner. But before we hear today's piece of animal comedy, given the importance of comedy to this show and to me personally, feel compelled to acknowledge the sad passing of Robin Williams, as I noted in a Facebook post just not long after his death was revealed. Many years ago, when I was a new aspiring talent manager, I spent one day a week at the management office that handled Robin Williams and several other major comedy stars, sort of an apprenticeship situation so I could learn talent management from some of the very best in the business. Anyway, Robin periodically came into the office, and I was just, you know, struck each time by how quiet, gentle, and enormously kind he was, especially in contrast to seeing him on stage doing stand-up. So, in all the comments and remembrances that have flooded in since Robin died, those that had direct contact with him, to a person pretty much, have noted that kindness, and I'd recommend along those lines, among others, finding the multi-tweet story by Norm MacDonald, as well as the anecdote recalled by the brilliant Dana Gould. Along those lines. Anyway, a very, very sad loss indeed. The words rest in peace, I think, particularly resonate here. Meanwhile, for today's Comedy Corner, we're extending our equine theme. This is Eddie Izzard with a piece called Horse Whisperer on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
Horse Whisperers, very touchy-feely horse trainers. Oh, there, boy. Oh, how tall are you? 15 hands. Oh. You got 15 hands? You're a Martian? A Martian horse over here. Oh, I see. 15 hands. Right. Glad we didn't measure it in feet. Everything's measured in feet except horses, which are measured in hands. What happened there? Someone should be... I'm 9 bottoms tall, you know. Really, are you? Yes. See that building? That's 29 bottoms high. He's 3 thighs tall. 4 kneecaps and a budgerigar. Well, horses measured in hands. What the... Anyway, the horse whisperer is obviously, oh, let's see. Horse is going, I can't quite hear what you're saying, actually. I tell you what I said was, why don't you... No, I still can't quite pick it up. Just seem to be going... Horse shouters should get a lot further, shouldn't they? Walk forwards, you, walk forwards. Walk, or I hit you with this child.
Eddie Izzard with a piece called Horse Whisperer, taken from his CD Live from Wembley. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'll be offering a spiffy Talking Animals t-shirt as the prize in today's Name of the Animal tune. We'll get to that in a moment here in Talking Animals. Right now, time for a few quick animal news and announcements, including a local story, but it actually made it onto a national feed of mine. Just read the headline in the very beginning. You can take it from there. But commissioners, changes likely needed in Manatee Animal Services Division. Dateline Manatee. Spurred by complaints from residents, Manatee County Commissioners Tuesday acknowledged changes may be necessary to the embattled Animal Services Division after speakers from rescue groups complained about findings included in a recent report showing the animal services staff had known for many years about substandard conditions at a private shelter in East Manatee. Commissioners acknowledge that changes may be needed. Quote, you can rest assured we're going to act upon it, Commissioner Vanessa Baugh told the audience. Goes on from there. Otherwise locally, but on a little more upbeat note, good deal more upbeat note, our friends from Pet Pal Animal Shelter remind us that tomorrow, August 14th, there's a Yappy Hour from 6 to 8 p.m. at the World of Beer, 104th Street in St. Pete. Always fun when you can have a brew with your dog at your side, right? Also, a reminder that the folks at Friends of Strays have their hurricane adoption specials continuing, promoting the adoption in particular of wonderful black cats and kittens by giving away a Friends of Strays Top 10 Reasons to Adopt a Black Cat t-shirt with each black cat or kitten adopted. They have all kinds of other cats as well. So friendsofstrays.com for that. One more reminder that Forever Yours Pet Rescue Event is happening at Dogism Sunday, August 24th from noon to 4 p.m. It's indoors, it's air conditioning, lots of animals for adoption, shopping, food, agility, more. You can find out more at Forever, F-U-R, Ever, Yours, Pet Rescue. That's, I think, going to do it for today's edition. I'm Duncan Strauss. You are listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to Name That Animal Tune. This is a giveaway you do not need to be a WMNF member to win, though why the heck wouldn't you be? We certainly encourage you to become one, and there'll be a prize, a Talking Animals t-shirt from our dwindling supply. Indeed, we're totally out of medium shirts at this point, but others are we have. First person who calls in 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song. It's named an animal tune on Talking Animals. kind of a gimme, I would think, given our equine theme for the day today, but who knows? We'll see if oh, looks like we might be starting to get some action. Oh, a lot of action. All right, let's do that right this minute in the order they came in. Hi, you're on Talking Animals. Can you name that animal tune?
Wild Horses.
How easy is that? And how appropriate as well.
That was an easy one.
What is your first name?
Teresa.
Teresa? Cool, Teresa. I will come back and get your information and send you off a Talking Animals t-shirt. Congratulations. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
We have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. I'll be back next Wednesday, August 20th, with Dr. Vint Verga, a veterinarian and behaviorist who works with animals of all kinds, from the Labrador with issues who lives in your home to the Ocelot with issues who lives in a nearby zoo, and his writing about both humans and animals of all stripes, particularly in his acclaimed book, The Soul of All Living Creatures, brims with a poetic elegance and eloquence. It's nothing short of extraordinary. I really look forward to speaking with Dr. Verga next week. I hope you'll join me for that. Meanwhile, also visit our website, talkinganimals.net, where we make available all sorts of information, as well as archives and podcasts of past Talking Animals programs, other stuff there as well. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Alternative Radio is next on WMNF. We're closing out today's show with an animal tune. One more horse song of sorts. This is Friends of Dean Martinez with All the Pretty Horses on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee and Beyond, Community Conscious Radio. Thanks for listening. Speak to you again next Wednesday at 9 a.m. on Talking Animals. Rest in peace, Nairobi. Rest in peace, Robin Williams. Thanks.